The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Brian, Judge Ross, Judge Bjorkman, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Brian presiding. Case A20-0493, GGG Incorporation, respondent versus John T. Samuelson, appellant.
Good morning, counsel. Good morning, colleagues. Thank you for being willing to participate this morning for our remote argument. Before we begin, I'd like to make sure that everybody can hear me. So if you nod or give me a thumbs up, and that way I know that I'm coming in loud and clear. And then I'd like to do the same for everybody else. So why don't I start with Judge Bjorkman.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning, everyone.
Mr. Rockney.
Good morning.
Good. I hear you loud and clear as well. Mr. Novotny.
Good morning.
Great. It looks like everybody's video and audio is working as we hoped. I do want to say a couple of things. First off, you can see the clock in one of the screens. And if you are in active speaker view, then the person talking is enlarged. And then there's some thumbnails, and the clock would be in one of those thumbnails. So you might not be able to view it very easily. So my suggestion is to make sure you're in gallery view before we begin, and you can toggle on the top right hand, you can toggle between the speaker view and the gallery view. That way you'll always know how much time is remaining. I also wanna say that because we're doing this remotely, there are from time to time interruptions, doorbells, pets, family members, that sort of thing. We'll do our best to keep these interruptions to a minimum, but we do know that sometimes these unexpected interruptions or glitches, technological glitches happen, and we'll, I want to thank you for your patience in advance if anything like that does happen, and we will, on the court side, also be patient with you if anything happens on your end. With that, why don't we begin with the arguments today? And Mr. Rockney, you may proceed.
Yes. Thank you. May it please the court. There are three main issues I'd like to address this morning. First is how the parole evidence rule applies to contract formation. Second is whether a violation of the rules of professional ethics for engineers voids the contract. And third is whether a contract is enforceable when there are unforeseen circumstances, which leads to an absurd result. First of all, on contract formation and the parole evidence rule, we're dealing with what was introduced and accepted into evidence as Plaintiff's Exhibit 2. It's a written proposal prepared by the respondent, G Cubed, provides for a deferred payment plan and a payment arrangement directly tied to sales of wetland credits. The advantage to my client, Samuelson, was that there was a deferred payment. He didn't have to come up with some upfront capital as part of this wetland project. Samuelson agreed to this financial arrangement based on discussions he had with Jeffrey Griffin, the principal of G-Cubed, that sales would be fairly quick, like within less than 2 years. And this was also reiterated in a cover letter introduced as Exhibit 113 by the defendant or the appellant that made clear the expectations of Samuelson were that sales would be completed within less than 2 years on this project and the in the range of $8,000 per acre. Now the court precluded Samuelson, my client, from testifying about these representations made by G-Cubed, which enticed Samuelson from entering into this unique deferred payment arrangement. The court precluded it based on the parole evidence rule. Court also excluded as parole evidence that Exhibit 113 cover letter that I referred to. G-Cubed's representations of quick sales within 1 to 2 years is what enticed my client Samuelson to signing this written proposal in the first place. This goes towards more of whether there was a meeting of the minds, the expectation of the parties, and essentially contract formation, which is where parole evidence is permitted. rather than whether the contract is in.
Before we get farther, I'm looking at the contract itself, and I know you make an argument about terms being missing, but you're not claiming the contract is ambiguous, correct?
It is missing essential terms, but the it is clear what the arrangement is. I would agree with that, that it's not ambiguous on its face, but rather the issue is more towards what were the meetings of the minds and the expectations of the party entering into the arrangement.
But the contract does have an offer. It has consideration for work to be done, and it clearly is accepted by your client by virtue of his signature, correct?
Right.
So what's your strongest argument that this parole evidence should have been admitted?
Because the whole gist of why my client entered into this arrangement was the representation that these sales would be done within 2 years in the range of $8,000 an acre. Otherwise, he wouldn't have entered into this agreement at all.
So your argument is not one of interpretation of the contract, but the validity of the formation or the existence of formation.
That's right.
So let me jump in there because I want to clarify, what do you think the standard of review is? According to the brief, under the standard of review section for this provision, you've written that the interpretation of a contract is a question of law, reviewed de novo, but you just told Judge Ross that this isn't a question of interpretation of the contract. So what do you think is the proper standard of review?
I think whether there was a meeting of the minds is a question of law for this court.
Why isn't whether there was a meeting of the minds a question of fact?
It has to do whether a valid contract was even formed. I mean, yes, there was an offer and an acceptance and there's consideration, but the circumstances surrounding the execution are that there were these expectations of the parties that this sale would be done within 2 years, and that didn't happen.
But Mr. Rockney, the circumstances surrounding the execution, those circumstances seem to me to be factual.
That's correct. And the judge actually precluded the evidence of those facts regarding the discussions that my client had with Mr. Griffin, and also precluded the introduction of Exhibit 113.
And counsel, what is the standard of review of the district court's decision not to admit parole evidence?
I think that's a question of law. But it has to do not whether the contract is ambiguous, but has to do with contract formation. In the cases I've cited, the MPS case and the Anderson case support that parole evidence is allowed in those instances.
I'm trying to get a sense of why we would apply a legal error standard versus an abuse of discretion standard for the admission of evidence.
Again, Your Honor, I would just say that it has to do with whether a valid contract was formed in the first place. Was there a meeting of the minds?
No, I understand that. But generally speaking, when it comes to what evidence is admissible, what evidence is relevant, those are generally questions of the court's discretion, given the trial court's closeness to the boots on the ground, if you will, in the middle of trial. I'm not sure if that necessarily undermines your argument. I'm just trying to frame the way we approach it.
I still think that when it's dealing with circumstances surrounding the execution of the contract, parole evidence is permitted and it should be a de novo review under the cases I cited.
And Mr. Rockney, just so I'm clear, you're not contending that the contract, Exhibit 2, was ambiguous, but that it was incomplete insofar as it omitted the term that you claim was at the heart of the contract, and that is that this would be done in 2 years.
Yeah, that's what enticed Samuelson for to sign the contract in the first place.
I guess I'm now foggy on your argument. I thought your position was the contract was sufficient and its terms were clear, and that your challenge to your factual issue is whether the contract was simply a matter of enticement as opposed to a free will bargain for agreement. if that's so, I don't know why the issue that you're raising would be something that would be ever included in the contract. Your argument is that the contract was never formed. I guess maybe am I misunderstanding your argument?
No, I think you're right, Your Honor. And to be honest, I think a lot of this ties into the later argument I want to make, and that is that whether this contract should be enforceable because there were unforeseen circumstances, namely that this length of contract went from what was expected by the parties to be within 2 years to more than 4.
If I could draw you back to the first issue and the parole evidence argument, what authority do you have that parole evidence can be considered when there's no ambiguity first? In other words, to establish whether there's a meeting of the minds, we don't typically call that evidence parole evidence. We usually first find ambiguity and then look to parole evidence to resolve that ambiguity. So what legal support cases are there that suggest we can consider parole evidence rule to determine the issue that you've raised, in my view, factual issue that you've raised about whether there's a meeting of the mind?
Well, Your Honor, I'm using the term parole evidence because that's what the trial court used. This testimony about formation of contract and this exhibit 113, I believe, again, have to do more with contract formation, whether it was a meeting of the minds. And the two cases I cited, the MTS case and the Anderson case in my brief, support that this type of evidence should have been admitted.
That's the problem. I guess that's my difficulty with your argument. And the parole evidence, the idea that parole evidence is admissible or not is indeed a question of law, but that's when we're looking at parole evidence in the context of what does the contract mean? You're asking for, however the district court framed it, you seem to be asking for evidence that is either admissible or not based upon relevancy, a matter for the district court to decide outside of the context, the usual context of parole evidence. Did you find any cases where the parole evidence doctrine is applied to questions of fact related to the formation of a contract?
I don't believe I found any cases on that particular issue, no.
So can we assume, at least for the sake of our argument, that, I don't speak for the panel, but from my perspective, that we're talking about a simple question of relevancy and admission of evidence and the abuse of discretion standard. Does that change your position or your argument as to whether the district court appropriately refused to admit the evidence and what the effect is?
If this court deems that the abuse of discretion standard is the proper standard, I still have to make this argument that Samuelson would not have entered into this arrangement at all without the expectation that these sales would have been done in quick format, like 2 years or less. I see I've only got about 3 minutes left. If I could just touch on the second issue, and that has to do with the violation of the rules of ethics under Minnesota Rules Section 1805.0300. The written proposal prepared by G-Cubed violates the rules of ethics for engineers, which prohibits conflicts of interest with clients unless there's full disclosure of the facts giving rise to the conflict. In this case, there's no evidence of any verbal or written disclosure of facts giving rise to a conflict of interest. And there is a conflict of interest here because Mr. Griffin entered into basically an arrangement to obtain an equity interest in Samuelson's project. Samuelson's expert, Jeffrey Broberg, who worked for the civil engineering firm of McGee and Betts out of Rochester, Minnesota at that time, testified that his firm would have never, ever entered into such an arrangement. They would always charge for fees for service basis and not.
Mr. Rockney, there was nothing hidden about that. I mean, that was the contract. I mean, the contract was, we don't get paid until you are able to sell the wetland credits. So how could that violate any licensing requirement if in fact that was a con- condition or term of the contract of which both parties were aware?
Well, Mr. Griffin prepared this proposal, and I think it does raise a clear conflict of interest. Mr. Samuelson entered into it trusting that Mr. Griffin would, again, complete these sales within less than 2 years and that everything would be fine. Well, everything wasn't fine. It took more than 14 years for this contract to be completed and sales to take place. And in the meantime, Mr. Griffin's taking advantage of the increase in wetland sales values over these years. And now he's claiming a judgment of over $173,000 for value of services that maybe are anywhere from 3% to 33% of that judgment amount. To me, that is a clear conflict of interest. There's a conflict of interest testified to by Jeffrey Broberg. And under public policy reasons, this contract should be void for that purpose.
So what authority is there that we can consider this void as to public policy or as against public policy argument for the first time on appeal?
I don't have any direct cases on point on this type of issue, but I do think that the policy, public policy requires that engineering firms in a superior bargaining position shouldn't take advantage of clients and gain an equity interest in projects, especially where the incentive then is for the firm to provide minimum effort in order to gain maximum return. In this case, a good example of the minimum effort put in by GQ is that there are absolutely no monitoring reports filed, which are required under the rules. Every year after the project is complete, there needs to be annual monitoring reports filed with the local government unit. And that was not done. So that's just one example of how GQ cut corners under this deferred payment arrangement. See, my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rockney. Mr. Novotny may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. Counsel, I'm Lee Novotny. I represent the respondent, GGG Incorporated. You may hear me refer to GGG as G-cubed or Griffin. The issues presented to this court, at least on brief, are many. I'll speak first to the issue presented orally here by appellant, specifically the parole evidence rule or the argument regarding contract formation. The contract here is plain and simple. The terms of the contract are straightforward. The testimony of appellant at trial indicates that he understood the contract. He agreed that he signed the contract. The contract does include offer, acceptance, and consideration, with those terms being very plain and straightforward.
Can I jump in just for a question to take you to where our discussion went with Mr. Rockney? I'm trying to get a sense of why this is characterized as parole evidence. If we're not talking about the meaning of the contract, we're talking about whether the parties had a meeting of the minds, whether the contract was formed at all or should have been formed at all because of alleged enticement. Can you address that question, whether we're even in the right ballpark discussing this as a matter of parole evidence?
I would agree that the argument of appellant perhaps is somewhat perplexing at the moment. it's my understanding that the evidence was being presented in an effort to explain the contract, or in that way explain the terms of the contract. In every contract examination, there are discussions that occur prior to execution, which, if admitted, are really admitted for the purpose of explaining what the terms of the contract are.
So is it your position then in the district court that this issue was only framed as a matter of contract interpretation, not as contract formation?
I believe appellant did request the make the argument to the district court that this evidence could also be considered for contract formation. And so that argument, what I believe, was presented to the district court. And so in that instance, I think the examination for this court is whether, on a factual standpoint, if the district court abused its discretion in whether or not to admit the evidence for the purposes of formation.
Okay, so let's start there then, because I tend to agree with your response. How is the district court acting within its discretion by excluding evidence that may bear upon whether the contract was entered into based on enticement? Or sometimes these cases come up in matters of fraud and other types of inducements to contract. How was it not an abuse of discretion to exclude evidence that allegedly bears upon the formation of the contract, given the fact that the argument included both the question of contract meaning and contract formation?
I believe at the time this evidence was being submitted, we're at a point in the trial where the judge had already heard evidence from both parties, I believe. And at that time, I believe the judge had heard testimony that both parties agreed that this was the contract that both parties had acknowledged that they executed this written contract, that there was no evidence from either party at that time to indicate that there was any anything improper as far as execution. And at that time, I believe appellant had already testified that this was in fact the contract that we were working under, that he fully understood the terms of that contract and was fine with the contract. So
I'm not sure how that addresses the question. Everything that you've just said in response to my question demonstrates that there was apparently not any dispute about what the contract says. My question is, I'm trying to get a sense of your position, since you've now taking the view that this is an abuse of discretion standard, at least as to the evidence bearing upon the formation of the contract. Even if there was agreement that this is what the contract says, whether the contract was enticed illegally seems to me to be a separate question as to what the contract means. So given that, what would be the basis for the district court's excluding the evidence?
And I don't believe that was the presentation of the argument to the lower court. But at the time, the lower court had to make a decision on whether or not the information in this proposed exhibit was relevant and probative and not prejudicial. And it would be my understanding that the court was able to review the information, and it made its determination that, based on the testimony and the contract on its face at the time, that it wasn't relevant, a relevant document.
Is that your position on appeal, that the district court did not abuse its discretion by excluding the evidence because the evidence was not relevant? Is that your abuse of discretion argument on appeal?
I'm not sure that I want to put words in the district court's mouth that it made that decision.
Right. So I'm trying to get a sense of on what evidentiary basis the district court's decision to exclude the evidence would be valid, not as to the meaning of the contract, but as to the formation of the contract. What's the evidentiary rule that you would cite that would justify the district court's decision?
I would say perhaps that this is it would be under a hearsay objection. This is a written instrument. Not hearsay, that this is a written instrument that was being offered, and the proposed or the drafter of this instrument was present and had testified in the court at that time, and that this written instrument, the statement made outside of court, was unnecessary. When we have the witness there testifying as to the facts that they're trying to present.
So then are you saying it's cumulative of other evidence?
I guess there's many factors. It is cumulative because Mr. Samuelson is there testifying, so it's cumulative to things that he is testifying about. I am going to go back to basically the judge made a relevancy decision at the same time it was. Reviewing this, I would say the judge's main consideration at the time was under parole evidence in the district court, but that the judge also determined that this evidence was not relevant or that its probative value was not there, that it should be admitted.
Okay, so help me to understand why that's a defensible position, that the evidence that is asserted that would, if believed, may lead a fact finder to conclude that there was no meeting of the minds. Help me to understand why the proposed evidence wouldn't support that assertion. And by wouldn't support, I mean, help me to understand why that proposed evidence is not probative of that question.
That's a decision that the lower court may had to have made, it made the determination whether, this is a transcription of a proposed fax is the best way I could say it. This was a typed out version of a handwritten fax that was sent many years ago, interpreting what that fax said because you really couldn't read the fax. Perhaps it's that the judge was relying on testimony of the actual of appellant, a typed transcription of a handwritten note.
Well, Mr. Novotny, we don't really have to go on this exercise of trying to read the judge's mind as to how this was addressed, right? Paragraph 10 of the findings and fact, page 4, it says Exhibit 113 is a handwritten fax from Samuelson to GGG. So it clarifies what it is. Doesn't say anything about it being unable to be read or a transcript of something. It's a handwritten fax. And then it says the trial court reserved ruling during trial. And then, quote, plaintiff's objection is sustained as parole evidence. So it's not like the district court considered it. It doesn't appear, at least based on the written order, that the district court considered this as a relevancy objection.
Well, agreed. The objection made was parole evidence. I do believe that there was an argument made by appellant regarding that this could be evidence of that could go towards a formation or execution argument. And I believe the transcript would show that the judge further sustained the objection or further, excluded it, I believe. Or I apologize. I believe the transcript will show that was presented as part of the trial and reserved, part of the reservation. So at this point, the only information we have is that the objection under parole evidence was sustained and therefore excluded. Correct.
Is there any place in the record you can point us to where the district court addressed the question under some other theory than parole evidence and the meaning of the contract, but instead address the issue that you've acknowledged was raised, which is the evidence bearing on the formation of the contract, the meeting of the minds of the parties?
At this specific moment, in the next 48 seconds, I'm not sure that I could find that exact point in the record. Memory serves me that there was a mention of it in the record, but for me to locate that at this moment, I think I'm at a disadvantage.
Mr. Novotny, you have less than 48 seconds because I want to switch gears. So before our time is up, I would like you to address this question. And as I looked at the record, I didn't see any dispositive motions being filed on the basis of a contract being voided to public policy, or on the basis of unconscionability, or even unjust enrichment, which, as I understand appellate's argument, is kind of in there in two different places. It's argument six, as well as the one that is captioned as unjust enrichment. So my question for you is, am I wrong in looking at the record and not seeing a dispositive motion or any motion as a judgment of matter of law or something like that addressing these purely legal issues?
I believe you're not. I don't believe they exist.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Rockney, rebuttal.
You're muted, Mr. Rockney.
Technology, sorry. Mr. Devontae's correct. The argument made at the hearing for motion for amended findings regarding the contract formation appeared like the court just summarily dismissed that argument and hung its hat on parole evidence rule.
Was the first time the argument was made at that stage, or was it made during the trial at the time the evidence was proposed? That is, did Mr. Samuelson make the argument at the time of the request for the evidence that it wasn't just a matter of parole evidence bearing on the meaning of the contract, but it was evidence bearing upon the formation of the contract?
We're not only talking about that Exhibit 113, the facts cover page, but we're also talking about discussions that Mr. Samuelson had with Mr. Griffin. And the court precluded that testimony based on the parole evidence rule.
Right. I'm just trying to get a sense. You said that the issue was raised at the time of the request for amended findings. My question is, at the time of the district court deciding whether to admit that evidence, was the evidence admitted based upon the idea of it bearing upon the formation of the contract, the meeting of the minds of the parties, and your enticement argument?
That was the purpose of the testimony and introducing the exhibit, but the court ruled to exclude that evidence based on parole evidence, and I had to move on.
So was there an offer of proof ever made at that time that the evidence would bear not just on the parole evidence question of the meaning of the contract, but based upon, but should be admissible for some other purpose, which is the formation of the contract and the meeting of the minds.
I don't know if there was an actual offer of proof made at the trial, but that was the purpose of the testimony.
Was the fact that that was the purpose of the testimony ever demonstrated, presented to the district court?
I think it was fairly clear why, because Samuelson only entered into that contract based on those facts given to him.
So I'll be more precise with that same question. The district court, in its order denying the motion for amended findings, says defendant offers no explanation as to how Exhibit 113 might undermine the existence or formation of the contract between the parties. Exhibit 113 does not affect the validity of the essential elements of the contract formation, nor does it cast doubt on the existence of an enforceable contract. That seems to be contrary to what you just said, that it was raised and that the explanation was given below.
It was given at the hearing for the motion for amended findings.
Isn't that too late?
No. That's why we're here on appeal now.
If you're challenging the admissibility, I mean, you're challenging the admissibility of the evidence. If you wait until the trial is over and you ask the court, you for the first time raise the issue that you are providing, you're seeking the introduction of the evidence for a purpose that wasn't clear to the district court at the time the argument was framed about around parole evidence. On what ground would we say the district court abused its discretion by not admitting the evidence if the district court was not made aware by your client of its purpose?
I thought that's the purpose for a motion for amended findings or new trial, or to make those arguments.
I know we've spent a lot of time on this, but let me ask another question on it, even though we spent some time. And that is, by my recollection and understanding, the district court reserves ruling during trial. And so you would have an opportunity after trial in your post-trial briefs to once again address the purpose for which you wanted to introduce 113. So can you point us to what argument was made after trial? So we have the trial transcript, we can find that. And then after trial, are you aware of an argument being made in those post-trial briefs regarding admissibility of 113 that we can look to see what explanation was given at that point? Because I see the district court's final conclusion that there was no explanation, and I want to see if that is correct, because you're saying it's not.
I believe there was a meeting of the minds. And in fact, even though this isn't in the record, going way back in our pretrial hearings, we made it clear to the judge that a meeting of the minds was the main.
I'm specifically looking at Exhibit 113. Once it's marked and offered, and how the district court used its discretion to rule on the admissibility of that exhibit.
Yes, the meeting of the minds argument was raised to the district court throughout these proceedings regarding contract formation. So that at that time, in the trial, the judge precluded or excluded the testimony and Exhibit 113 based on parole evidence. I would venture to say that even if the standard of review here is abuse of discretion, that the judge did abuse its discretion by not allowing this evidence in, because again, under the enticement argument that I already made. As far as any other rebuttal, I really don't have any. I don't necessarily want to repeat arguments or make any new arguments if the scope of my rebuttal is limited to what was argued by Mr. Novotny. So I'll stop my response right now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rockney, and thank you, Mr. Novotny. We will take the matter under advisement and issue a decision within the statutory timeframe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a nice day.